Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Two Narrings podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined, as always, my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Dave Cashman is our guest today. How's the farm, Dave?
Not too bad, lads. How are you doing?
We're here to talk about trauma and farm education. But before we get into that, you're from a big GA family, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well known?
Yeah, relatively well known anyway, yeah. So
you're a Black Rock man?
Black Rock man, yeah.
Rockies so, was your club?
Yeah. Played senior up until a couple of years ago there.
Where were that?
Yeah, so.
Were you part of the carry-on during COVID?
No, I actually missed that.
I'd say you were in the middle of that now, Dave.
I missed it.
So for the people that don't know, they won a county final, which is a big thing in Cork.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
But it was in the middle of COVID when you weren't supposed to be outside your door. I'm sure. Yeah. Them gurriers out the south side took no heed of that.
I wouldn't know, I wasn't there at all.
But listen, if you win a county final, you have to celebrate it, don't you?
Yeah. Well, like, I was lucky. I won two early on in my career. Like, I was only about 18 or 19, and I played in four senior finals.
Go ahead.
2-1-2. But,
yeah. Your uncle is one of the most decorated hurlers of all time.
Yeah, Tom and, well, Jim won a few All-Irelands, and Tom would have won four, and he was, I think Tom was, selected on the team of the century back in the '82, and he actually, I remember you sent me a text message there. You were right, Jimmy Bradley.
That's right. Yeah,
then he didn't win the Echo Cork hurler all time there.
No, he didn't.
That recently,
actually, like, we had the honor of interviewing Dave or Teddy Mack actually not long ago, not long before he passed away.
Yeah,
you know, that was a huge shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, and actually, Jim and Teddy would be best friends, like, older.
Yeah.
They would have been the same age, and Teddy was only with him the week before, so shock and a huge loss to Cork GA and Cork in general. Like,
yeah, absolutely. But you're doing a PhD, and how we met initially was we both got the same scholarship for the PhDs. I'm going to come away to do this podcast, but you're nearly finished now.
Yeah.
And you're going to talk to us a little bit about that.
Kind of, yeah.
But you're also the principal in Educate Together, Southleigh.
Southleigh Educate Together, yeah. So we're a new school over in based in the grounds of Colossus Stefan Neff.
And did you start out as a primary school teacher?
I did. Well, I started out, like, I suppose when I go back, I finished school and I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do, to be honest with you. Do you know, I went to college and I initially did arts, and after that, then I did a postgrad in UCC in business economics. It was that time, it was kind of around the time of the Celtic Tiger, and everyone was kind of saying you should go into kind of businessy kind of subjects, you know, and I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. And really, I had zero interest in it. You know, I was always involved in hurling and I was always involved in sport and coaching, and I coached a lot of teams underage, and I got a fierce amount of enjoyment out of it and helping basically the young teams in Blackrock, and we kind of had a bit of success along the way too. But, you know, I got really huge amount of enjoyment out of it, and I decided to go back teaching, and I enrolled. I got into the postgrad in education, and one of my first jobs then I taught in Douglas, and I was doing a bit of sub teaching in Douglas. This was before I was qualified back those years. There was a serious shortage of teachers, and I was kind of doing a bit of subbing in Douglas, in the autism class over in Douglas Boys School, and they were looking for a sub to teach in the autism class. At the time in Cork, there was only two autism classes. There was one in called Padre Pio in Churchfield, and the other was in Douglas. So they'd kind of share subs. So I went up and I was teaching in Scolpadre Pio, and I went up expecting to be teaching there, and I got put into the early start.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was great crack. And I remember the parents every day. It was my first kind of real kind of insight into the north side. They used to be calling me kindergarten cop there for every day when they collected, you know. So I taught there for a couple of weeks, and I stayed there for nearly the bones of a year, you know. I was teaching there for the bones of a year, and ended up teaching. Then I got a permanent job down in Strawberry Hill in Sundayswell Boys School.
Yeah.
Taught there for a number of years, and I became principal, deputy principal and principal there after about like 6 years. Was principal.
That's some achievement.
Yeah.
For a teacher to pick one and become deputy and then principal after 6 years.
Yeah.
What age, yeah?
30. Yeah.
Well, that's common for somebody so young to be in senior position like that.
Yeah, it wouldn't be uncommon. No, definitely not. Like, we'll probably talk about that at some point. It's a really, the job now is kind of very difficult. It comes with a lot of occupational stress, I suppose, you know. And, but yeah, it is a lot more common now.
Yeah.
And
can I ask you something?
Okay.
You know, when you have the old school teachers, you know, teachers that myself and James would have had in primary and secondary school, in one section,
but they're
more or less maybe coming to their retirement age and whatever. But then you have the new younger generation of teachers coming in. I often wondered how the newer generation teachers would get on with the older ones and their kind of how their strategies into teaching and maybe disciplining kids and stuff. What was your experience with some of that?
Yeah, like, I'll be honest with you, know, when I came into Strawberry Hill, there was a couple of older teachers there that, and I really learned a lot from them. The teachers that were there, they were actually very kind, and they really did want the best for the kids. So I never kind of experienced the whole old style print teacher, to be honest with you. Like, at the time, there was my first principal when I was in Strawberry Hill was Michael Walsh. He's still one of my best friends to this day. He's just retired there a number of years ago. Antonia Farrell was the deputy principal, and Paddy Lynch ended up taking over. And like, they were nearly, I suppose, ahead of their times in the way they kind of looked after and all the kids that kind of, I suppose, needed an arm around their shoulder. They needed the kind of secure base and the secure attachment type relationship. And I kind of learned a lot from them, to be honest with you. I get where you're coming from, though.
And what do the new generation of teachers bring to you?
Yeah, so like, I suppose, teaching is completely different from when we started. Like, you know, it's very play-based. And, you know, the Ashtar curriculum in the early years is excellent in terms of developing a play-based pedagogy, you know, and you want your kids to be active in their learning. You want them to be, I suppose, engaged in learning. And that's the way kind of education is now. It's that it's very engaging and it's very active. And I think that's what a lot of the new teachers that are coming out are, I suppose, they're bringing to the table. They're bringing a lot of like explorative learning as well, which is really good going.
A lot of people won't know what pedagogy means.
Yeah, I suppose different types of ways of teaching things.
Yeah,
basically, trying to do different types of ways of doing things. Like Ashtar, for example, I'll just give you an example of it. In from junior infants to kind of second class, you learn through a theme. So you might have the theme of, we'll say, the garden centre. And you'd have one station, which would be construction area, and they'd build the garden centre. Next would be a small world area where you'd have act out scenes in the garden centre. Or then likewise, then you'd have a socio-dramatic area where they actually dress up and they do things. And we actually nearly bring in plants and they plant things for them. And then you have your junk art where you use basically materials to make stuff that you might see in the garden centre. The same thing might be the airport, it might be the police station, the hospital, the doctors. So you're trying to teach kind of social situations through play, basically.
And the life learning. Did they have like a kind of a critical pedagogy where the children up there would be very socially and politically aware, and there'd be a sense of activism about it as well, you know?
Yeah.
So
pretty much the same. It's similar in Educate Together schools as well.
Quality
based. So like, there's four pillars to Educate Together schools. So one is their equality based, child centered, democratically run. So we listen to the student voice and the parent voice and teacher voice. And then it's co-educational. So all educational together schools are are co-educational.
What do you notice a lot of, you know, in your school, do you notice a lot of the kids that are going there prefer to learn on a practical base, like the art, maybe the PE, maybe some of the maybe woodwork classes and things like that? Is that, are schools becoming more familiar around what's important to kids these days? Because not every child is academic. You know, not every child wants to sit down and learn, because we were speaking beforehand, you have to fight, fly and freeze. You know, I remember when I was in school, I wasn't academic, and when I came across an issue on the board or on the maths book or whatever, I would freeze and then I would become very anxious. And then that voice in my head where I had this belief that I was stupid and taken would start playing. You know, so what's the approach? You know, if you have a child now that's dyslexic or dyspraxic or whatever, how do you approach a child like that today?
Well, like, I suppose early intervention is probably key, you know, and like what will happen a lot of the times is you kind of see it in the early classes. And we like in our school, I'm just going to give you an example of, we like, this is probably different from a lot of schools, but in say in junior infants, what we try and do is we have a lot of outdoor learning. So then we have the literacy group in a small group. So half, when the kids come in, actually might talk to you even about how we start the day, really, yeah. Because transition from home to school is a big thing. And I was talking to you beforehand, like, about, you know, having a kind of trauma-informed school and trauma-aware school. And like, one of the first things is the start of the day and the transition from home to school. So in our school, we start at 8:30, but the gates open at 8:15. And the first thing, like first thing I do every morning is 8:15, I stand at the gate and meet and greet, meet every child, either shake their hand, give them a high five or say hello to them. And just, it might be something small, but then there's another layer then that we have more teachers afterwards after me who do the exact same thing. My deputy is brilliant. We've coupled some other teachers who do the exact same thing. But then you always have someone as well looking out for a child that is a bit anxious about coming to school, and they're allowed play in the yard for the first 15 minutes then. So then we go into class and we have a soft start. Soft start is kind of just having manipulatives and you getting your brain working through fine motor skills. It might be a small bit of building. It could be peg work or something like that. But it's important that that's done nearly in every classroom. I was just in a school there, Blarney Street Boys School there, and it's Boys and Girls School now, actually, sorry. And they had Sharon Lambert in with them, and she actually said the same thing about having those fine motor activities as a kind of positive primer for the day. It's priming the brain to get ready to learn.
So you're not like sitting down in the class, right, lads, proud jaw, busy at maths.
Yeah, straight away.
And then Barry, do you remember them?
Yeah. And Barry and had a van, Barry had a lorry.
I seen something on social media, it was a few years ago, I think it was in Palestine. It was in a school for, I'm going to say, 10-year-old. There's a 10-year-old's class. There was a teacher. And when he's standing by the door as the kids come into the school, into the class, and he points to the wall, and on the wall there's four or five different pictures. And yeah. One is a picture of somebody getting a hug.
One is a high five.
One's a fist bump. And one is just leaving him alone. And when he comes in, he's waiting. The child then points to what they want. And then he gives them a hug, he gives them a fist bump, or he just leaves them alone. And they choose how they...
And you'd be surprised how common that is now in schools. Like, you genuinely would. Yeah. And what I love sometimes is there, I had one of my junior infants there, and I send around a social story to all of our junior infants before they start school with things in it to kind of trying to get them ready for school. And on one of them was a picture of me saying, "This is Dave. I'll be at the gate every morning. I'll give you a high five." And there was a couple of mornings I didn't give her a high five, and she was giving out to her mom that I didn't give her a high five, you know. So it's amazing, the small things make a big difference.
Yeah.
But having someone then on call ready to see anyone who is anxious about coming to school, and then having a safe space for them to go to in school, then your soft start. And then we have a morning meeting. So in the first 20 minutes of the day, it's very, very much getting children in a ready to learn zone, so that they're ready to learn. The morning meeting, they come in and sit around in a circle, kind of like this, and they have a bit of a greeting first, introduce themselves to the group, even though they know each other for years. Then we do a check-in, so it could be an emotional check-in where you kind of color code it in zones of regulation, or it could be at two thumbs. How are you feeling today? I'm feeling good, but I'm feeling tired. Mm-hmm. But it's constantly developing that emotional literacy so that children can tell you how you feel. And then you can actually get into the learning side of thing after you have the positive start of the day and the positive primer of the day. Transitions then again. You know, remember when you're in yard, you go to yard and you're playing ball. Well, the game doesn't go your way and you're like a dog and tensions are high. Like, you take those games very seriously. Like, you know,
then you're doing long division tournaments
there. Yeah. So like we identified that as a kind of a transition from yard back into school. So how do you bring down the temperature? So we step it. So we have four whistles and then three. And on those first four or three whistles, the kids are allowed to walk around the yard and talk, but they have to tidy up and leave it in the place leave it in the way they have it. So you're teaching them that they have a bit of responsibility and respect for their surroundings, but you're also just dialing down the temperature. Right, like Dan Siegel, he calls it connect and redirect. You're allowing them to connect, but you're redirecting them away from the highness. And then we bring them in together. We have two whistles and then one. And then we do a whole school breathing activity. So you're trying to teach them different breathing techniques that they can use as life skills. And any kind of negative emotion, using the 90-second rule to come out of like the loop of negative emotions, you know. Mm-hmm. So those transitions and routines, like we were chatting a while ago about Bruce Perry. And Bruce Perry, he talks about like the neurosequential model of therapeutics. But that's also translated to the neurosequential model of education.
What does that really mean?
What does it mean? Yeah, I was just going to say it like in layman's terms, like if you imagine it, like the brain as an upside down triangle, right? And you have the brain stem at the bottom. And if you're under chronic stress and you're under, if you've experienced adverse childhood experience, adverse childhood experiences, or if you're under chronic stress, from a multitude of reasons, you're living in the brainstem, like you're living in amygdala hijack. You're basically
fight or flight.
And Bruce Perry,
rational thinking.
Yeah, but Bruce Perry, if you imagine the analogy of an upside down triangle, so at the bottom you have regulate, so a child needs to regulate before they can relate, and then they need to relate before they can reason. So what it's kind of saying is, right, allow a child to regulate first. Then he can relate and form trusting relationships with the adults in the school. And then the executive function or the kind of like the learning can happen. So like I kind of like
the soft start.
Yeah.
You know, at the
so bringing it in softly at the start of the day, you're regulating them to get them ready to have relationships basically and positive relationships. And then you can actually enable them to be ready to learn.
Because you don't actually know what a child is coming from. You don't know where that child is coming from walking in your door. They may have came from a home that there was mad stuff going on all night and they probably didn't get too much sleep. You know, there may have been violence or drug addiction or whatever else may have happened, and they're walking in the door and their head is still stuck in them trying to understand what has just happened the night before.
Yeah.
And they could be blaming themselves and they mightn't be in no form at all to relate. But if you're going in there and they see a smiling face, that can change the whole perception. But if they're going in there and there's a teacher shouting and roaring at them because they forgot their homework or weren't able to do it, that child is getting the message that there's something wrong with me. Everybody's giving me shit. Everybody.
Yeah.
And they start getting that core belief system then that we were speaking about earlier on. But just core beliefs starting to build up within the child at the young age because of the way adults are treating them. And then they start going on to start to believe that they're bad people. And that's why everybody's treating them badly. They don't understand that maybe the adults in the family home are struggling with mental health or drug addiction or their own stuff. And maybe going into school, then they might be dealing with a teacher that doesn't read, it's not trauma informed and doesn't understand what's going on in that child's home. You know, can you
speak
a little bit about that?
Even like, I suppose, even when you're going back, when you bring it back to, I suppose, the brain architecture and things like that, like when you're living in the brain stem or the reptilian brain, you're kind of asking, am I safe? And then when you go to the limbic system, your emotional side is, am I loved? And then those are the two kind of core things that you kind of need to think of, right? One, everyone needs to experience a secure base and a sense of safety. And sometimes that's important, that like if a child doesn't experience that at home, that they do experience it at school. And there are a number of ways of doing that, like creating that consistency of approach, you know, like body language and tone. They're very, very important things. We spoke about restorative practice a while ago, yeah, which is fantastic, but it has to be integrated in with your body language and tone and a kind tone. And like, I suppose when I think back, when I was sometimes, I know this is diverting from the question you asked me, but when I was a young teacher, like, I'll never forget, some of the things that I suppose you have misbehavior and you get triggered yourself, and then you kind of nearly take it as a challenge, and your body language goes wrong and your tone goes wrong, and then you dysregulate the child more, and then they dysregulate you more, and it turns what could be a simple situation to solve into a huge moment of de-escalation for both the adult and the child. So for me, a trauma-informed approach actually is for the adult to be able to say, look, this is what's happening. I'm experiencing dysregulation, and I'm now in a kind of fight, flight or freeze as well. And I kind of don't know how to handle this. So I just need to take 10 minutes to to regulate, like, you know, and disengage for a couple of minutes so that I can actually come back in a meaningful way and show the child I care and I'm there for them. Sometimes actually leaving the situation is the best option, you know. You know, but it's, again, particularly when you're a young teacher or when you've just started out, you feel like you need to solve all of the problems yourself, or it's a sign of weakness, where it's not. And a lot of the times we have to be a small bit vulnerable and say, right, I just need to actually find out more, and I need to regulate myself before I go back and actually
deal with it. Is there any trauma-informed module or element to the core teacher training?
No, not in
the proper
grade. Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
Because your base, and then the quality of education, trauma-informed education, based off, I suppose, the ethos of the principal or individuals.
Yeah, do you know what I will say?
Standardized.
Do you know what I will say, right? So, there's a trauma-informed module in Maynooth, in Cristina O'Toole has one there for the Masters in Education, and there's one in UCC as well. I think there's one in CIT with Judith as well. I don't know if you know Judith Butler and Maria Lotti, but they're not compulsory, they're elective, right? But what you have in kind of core education is a module on classroom management and a module on kind of like special ed, right? But the classroom management stuff is based on behaviorist principles. Like, so again, what I mean by that is like a star chart and a reward, good behavior.
Conditioning.
Conditioning. Like,
why would something so important not be compulsory within the structure of the teachers?
It's just, I suppose, a lot of kind of systems working in silos.
If you look at what it would mean for a teacher to be trauma-informed, that could change the whole outcome of a child's belief of how school is.
And that actually brings me to actually how it happened for me, to be honest with you. As I said, it was principal in Strawberry Hill, and so I was also kind of quite involved in Young Knocknaheeny at the time. It's Let's Grow Together Now. And we were getting a lot of training. And at the time, the Cork City Council kind of funded Karen Treisman. I don't know if you've ever...
I was at it.
Yeah.
And City Hall.
Yeah. So you had the two... There was one in City Hall and one in Rochestone Park.
I was at the City Hall one a couple of days there.
And for me, that was kind of transformational in my approach in education, to be honest with you. I found that when I learned about stress and the brain, chronic stress in the brain, adverse childhood experiences, how all of those things impact on a child's natural development. Once you know it, you can't unknow it. And that's what I found, was that like it was that kind of layer of knowledge that was missing. Likewise, I don't know if you've ever come across nurture training. Susan Gibney delivers it in Ireland. There's a lot of kind of trauma-informed kind of principles behind nurture trainings. Essentially, what a nurture room is, it's based on attachment theory. So attachment theory is basically when you're young, you're born and you form a bond with a caring adult. Normally it's your mom. And basically when you cry, you're soothed. When you're upset, she knows how to soothe you. And it those interactions form an attachment theory. Sometimes those things are missing.
Yeah.
So a nurture room basically is a room in the school that has a kitchen area, has a living room area, and kids are brought there. And the first thing they do is actually have a cup of tea, slice of toast with a trusted adult. So you're
going to have one of those in Knocknaheeny Secondary School for the first years going in. They have a kitchen space,
yeah.
seating area, and they just, all the first years go in there and they have their lunch up there for the first year.
Yeah, and I think, again, though, those trauma-informed principles, like I was talking to another one of the principal, and he was an older principal, and he said, I just wish when I was in college in the 80s, I was taught about this, because it would have changed some of the moments that you had over the course of your teaching career, you know.
And it's no fault of any teacher.
No.
Because it's like nobody intentionally treats another human being in the wrong manner. It's just some conditioning. And I suppose when you know better, as Gillian Butler says,
yeah,
you do better.
You do better. And it's actually so true.
Yeah.
You know, like...
But why are we so... Like, why is the trauma-informed thing only coming around now, when psychologists have probably been talking about trauma's effect on people for 100 years?
Yeah. Like, do you know what they say about research? It takes like 20 or 30 years for actually... research tech.
You'll be dead and buried by the time that.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. But it's so true, isn't it? It does take a long time.
Wrap my head around is why the answers are there for the education system. Why aren't they being implemented for the best education system to teach every child that has their own individual learning differences and behavioural issues the right way?
Is there objections to it from the Department of Education, or is there a clash in ideologies, or like
do you know, it's funny you say it, like, because, like, you know, in the US at the moment it's very partisan between the Republicans and Democrats. I was talking to a guy over there he works in sustainability in the US, and I was talking to him recently, and he was saying, like, every time you kind of put some sort of intervention in sustainability, it's kind of, you have to be very, it's a very, very thin line, because it's so partisan, you know.
Yeah.
In Ireland, I don't think there is, but what I think it is that there's just too many silos in our system. Like, there's no real joined up thinking, where you even within, I suppose, Department of Education, there's so many different silos doing different things, and everyone means well. Everyone's trying to do the right thing, but it's just that there's no kind of joined up thinking to pull it all together. And even the way trainings are delivered, again, it becomes really, really challenging, because there's loads of different silos. And likewise, there's a bit of gatekeeping then as well. There's kind of, sometimes there's an element of, this is the way we've always kind of done it, like, you know. So like, I think it's just that lack of joined up thinking is the difficulty. I think
we met the Secretary General of the Department of Education a few weeks ago. Very nice fella. I have his number on my phone.
Could text him there.
Not bringing him on, or
yeah.
Phone call. Say, yeah, he's the man that can get it done. Like if it was a director from the department, then
yeah.
Like, if you want this teaching job, you have to do this. Then as Timmy's right, like, it's, the evidence is clear. Why isn't it being done?
Yeah, and like, I don't know who was saying this, but I think you're at the same conference as me. Trauma-informed practice is best practice. Like,
yeah,
it creates the conditions.
There's no, like,
for learning that
ambiguity around that.
No,
know what I mean, that's not up for debate. Like, but is there a sense of some principals and some schools, they don't want to deal with those type of children? And I'm not going to name no schools, like that, but there's a certain couple of schools in the north side that would have different ideologies around this stuff. In this school here, they'll get expelled for innocuous stuff, and they end up over in this school then, who would see that innocuous stuff as the trauma response, you know.
Yeah.
But from this school's perspective, and I don't know anybody in this school, in this school's perspective, it's easier for them to just get rid of those challenging children and just be left with the people that are academically able and motivated.
Yeah.
And then you have the more principals like yourself then you see that challenging child and you see a lot of potential there. You see the child that needs to be helped, not the student that's causing the problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I would say what I kind of think sometimes is like...
You have to be careful now because you're a principal conference there. You'll be...
No, do you know what I was thinking? I was thinking as you were talking there, you know?
Yeah.
Like the transition thing, going back to even the transition and... Like in general, primary schools, to be honest with you, because you have the same teacher all day long, and because you don't have exams, your kids get really taken care of. Like in modern primary schools,
but we've always said that. Like in primary school, you have the one teacher, they know you, the family, and all that. When you go into secondary, it is a culture shock.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
and it's very much like. You're in science, maths, geography, 40 minutes the buzzer goes, different class, different teacher. Some children get lost in that, and I did myself.
Yeah, and also there's like inconsistency as well in terms of like personalities. Like yeah. So you're like, if you have a child that's actually has experienced trauma, and like, we might even talk about the terminology of the whole trauma thing there in a while as well, yeah. Because like, that actually brings another thing. I know Don hates it, the whole trauma-informed practice thing, yeah. Like, and it's like, and I kind of would be similar. I think it's a kind of a basic human right, to be honest with you. I'd nearly prefer to see it as like human centered education as opposed to trauma. Yeah. Like that it's for everyone. It's not for the percentage that have experienced trauma.
But it's for everyone. It's for everyone to understand so they can understand each other.
Yeah.
So, and they can treat each other with respect and not throw down judgment in somebody who behaves in a different way to the way they do or the way they've thought to be normal growing up. Because, and that's what trauma, that's the best understanding for me around trauma informed, and what it means to me is so others who don't understand it and who haven't lived that exact experience as this child here who's been completely traumatized growing up because of their environment. So this human being here who has had a loving and caring family, school, all these different things growing up, can understand why this child here is behaving in this way.
Yeah.
And they can have some compassion and care for them without judgment.
And look after, and people, and kind of engage in people to look after each other.
And that's why I would love for everybody to get trauma informed.
Yeah.
I think it's something that we should introduce into schools at the youngest possible age for them to understand where they can understand the whole subject, because it will change humanity and that people will treat each other. They'll look across it's like this. If there's a teacher up there and they're talking about trauma informed practice on the board, and there's two children here sitting down, and there's this child here who's had all the best things growing up, this and there's another child over here and they have nothing and they're actually worried about what they're going home to. That child that's sitting here on the left might look at the board and they might have an aha moment, because what the teacher's trying to explain on the board, and they look after that child and say, fuck, I never again going to speak like him, like that to him, or going to treat him like that, or going to bully him or pull him down, you know. And that's That's what's important to me.
And having
kids can have it.
And teaching a bit of compassion as well for each other, yeah. And like, back to kind of what we were saying, like the whole, I think that there is a big kind of like one, I suppose, the positive side of things, like, we I think we all know some amazing school completion workers as well, yeah. Who I was just chatting earlier about Ingrid there, who is a really good friend of mine, does amazing work and has been since I know her, like going back like 15 years up in the Northside schools. I think like support for all of those type of organizations like our school completion programs, I think we need more kind of support where we can have like trusted adults, like for like Ingrid is doing nurture and her team, all the guys in the school completion team, they do nurture without even ever been trained in it.
Mm.
You know, they are trauma informed without even realizing they have been for the last 15 years. So some of it comes from a bit of intuition as well, like, you know, but again, the exam system in the secondary schools doesn't help our most vulnerable kids anyway, definitely not, like, you know, like it, because again, it adds another layer of accountability and high stakes accountability in terms of like, you know, we're probably at an age now of like well-being and identity and learning, where we're trying to bring well-being and learning together. That's what Andy Hargreaves would say anyway, right? But, you know, it's really, really difficult when at the end of the day, in secondary schools, we have to prepare the kids for exams. Mm. And ultimately, sometimes that just becomes the bottom line when kids go into secondary school. For schools is like exam, the exams become, I suppose, they have the power, like it's, the exam becomes like a powerful thing where you're kind of, where it can define your life outcomes, you know. Mm. And that's I think one of the problems in secondary school is like the pressure of exams, and then the pressure of exams on teachers and on staffs.
Have you any opinions on a better system for secondary school?
I think GEMS, on a personal level, I think we should focus more on well-being and show kids how to regulate, how to process stuff. And I think the educational stuff, once they can do that other stuff, the education will come second hand, because they'll be able to focus more, because they're regulating, because they know how to talk, they can understand their own stuff that's going on from in their lives. Yeah. No, and they're not afraid to talk. You know, and education is very, very important. But could all the children get lost in the education system because they haven't got the ability to get the education?
In primary schools, actually, there's a new curriculum coming this year, actually. And well-being is an actual, for the first time, is a strand that's given the same time allowance. Now, they've grouped in well-being with like physical education and well-being and kind of SBHE kind of stuff. But it's been given the same time allowance now as literacy and numeracy, which is really kind of, I suppose,
that's good.
It's a really positive change, and it's a new curriculum that has just come in for all primary schools. Like it's literally, it was in the draft kind of framework for the last couple of years, but it's being embedded over the next 2 years, which is really positive as well. Like, you know,
talk to us about your own framework.
My own framework, yeah. So the title of my PhD is, it's bear with me now, because when I say it there, sometimes people don't have a clue what I'm talking about. It's the design development, or design implementation and evaluation of a systems and trauma informed model of positive education. So what I've kind of looked at was, the first thing I looked at really was the literature on positive education. And positive education is applying positive psychology to education settings. And Martin Seligman, have you ever heard of him?
No.
He's the kind of coined the phrase positive psychology. And then positive education came from it. And there was a number of studies done in different places about applying positive education and how basically well-being and academic achievement can actually go hand in hand. You can actually have both. Exactly what you're saying, basically. So that's what kind of positive education is. And so then I kind of was looking at the literature and I read this book called Contextual Wellbeing by a lady over in Australia called Helen Street. And so subsequently I've had numerous kind of like Zooms with, I read it during lockdown and we had a couple of Zoom messages too. And basically she kind of argues that wellbeing and positive education and wellbeing in schools, it's kind of like you can't have a one model fits all. It's all based on context. Every school context is different because of the location, because of the people. And basically she kind of looked at kind of how, I suppose, every context is different, but you have to kind of co-create your model with the school. So what I kind of did then was I kind of said, right, look, I'm going to look at wellbeing of principals, look at well-being of, and I'm going to interview principals, I'm going to look at well-being of teachers, I'm going to look at well-being of kids through a student voice piece. And kids was a great one actually, because I did a photo voice piece, allowed them to take pictures of what makes them feel well in school, and then they kind of led the interview rather than me interviewing it. And then I kind of put together a framework based on that and the parent voices too. I'm putting a framework together, and what I kind of put together first of all was about collective teacher efficacy, the power of the team, and having consistency amongst the adults. Like,
what's collective
teacher efficacy? Yeah, so it's a concept by a researcher called John Hattie, and basically it just shows that the collective belief among staff and the collective practice among staff produces far more successful student outcome than any other thing.
So the collective belief is everyone believing
that they can make a difference, but everyone actually acting
on it as well.
We can all believe, yeah,
but it's the action means more.
Exactly. Than anything else. So it's like this collective kind of collective culture is what I call it, right? So I kind of looked at that then and I was like, what consistency is needed in schools? So we looked at touch points, right? Kind of to some of the things we were talking about a while ago, the greeting in the morning, the meet and greet and end and send. How do we meet in the morning and how do we send them away? There's another one then, like checking in. I try and check in on the staff every morning, regardless. I heard a principal in Dublin refer to it as tucking the kids into bed. Mm-hmm. So you go around takes 15 minutes of your time. You can spare 15 minutes of your time to make sure all the staff are okay. But then if there's any problem with any kids or any kind of child that's worried or anxious or having a difficulty, that basically I know about it and we can do something about it and we can bring someone in to help them. So in having that kind of as a collective practice, basically, how our routines are, how our transitions are, and our language, what language we use to get attention, what language we use, having a neuroaffirmative strength-based language. Like, so every school in the country will have autistic children in their class. They'll have children with various other different needs, but having the respectful language around it, yeah, and having it as a kind of like a collective language base that we actually use across the school, and it's a respectful language.
As you said something there, Dave, and I just think it's important to ask you this question because I'm after asking it to a few academics and experts that we've had in the past. What do you believe the rise in autistic kids is today compared to what it was years ago?
Well, there's
such a debate around, is it the food? Is it what we're drinking? Is it processed food? Is it sugars? Or is it just
pollution in the environment?
You know, or is it just that years ago we didn't know what autism
was? More diagnosed.
I wouldn't know, to be honest with you, and I don't know that. Like, I will say, like, I suppose awareness is a kind of a thing if you didn't know what to look for. And then again, like, we could be coming back in 20 years and, like, at the moment, like, the girls kind of have different autistic traits than boys. So we could come back in 20 years and say we missed all of this as well in 20 years in girls.
Yeah.
Do you know? Because girls typically would have the kind of, would have a quieter demeanor.
Yeah.
So you just don't know.
Same with ADHD.
It's the same with ADHD. It's the same with any, I suppose, additional need that's there. awareness is everything, so you just don't know. It could always have been there. It's just now we're more aware of things.
You know, in your school, is it expensive for people to send, or is it?
Oh, no, it's free. Yeah, yeah. And actually, it's not.
So it's not like this kind of posh school. It's not for everybody.
No. And to be fair, I'm going to be the first to say it as well. Like, well, we have fantastic staff and we have a fantastic school. We have fantastic parents and fantastic children. But there are loads of fantastic schools that are doing the same, if not more, than mine. Like schooling now, in primary level is fantastic, you know? And like there are schools around the country doing amazing, amazing stuff.
You have to take your hand off to the teachers.
Yeah.
You have to, because I tell you, they're doing some amazing work. I've been working with different teachers in the last few years around different projects and whatever else, and I have to say it, like, the compassion and understanding that they have for some of the kids, you know, some particularly those kids that are struggling and who have behavioural issues, you know, it's like they understand them and they can meet them at their level. I think it's amazing, and there's a lot to be said for teachers as well.
Can I just say one thing as well, one of the things when I did the research with teachers, you know, and you might think it was like dealing with behaviours was kind of driving, was I call it either enabling well-being or inhibiting well-being, right? You think it's actually dealing with the behaviour that is the thing that inhibits well-being. That's not at all, actually. What it is that what I found was that talking through it is it's the occupational guilt of not knowing what to do and how to help the child. Everyone really wanted to help the children. But it's the access to services. Like children that have sensory processing difficulties, not having access to an OT to tell you how you can help the child in school. It created this mad sense of occupational guilt. And that was the inhibitor of well-being, not actually the actual dealing. I think everyone wants to do the right thing by children, but it's the guilt of just not knowing what to do. Mm. So I think access to services was a thing. And also what I've kind of done as well, I've brought in an occupational therapist into my training program. I thought it was kind of funny there, you calling me like an expert or an academic. I don't think I'm any of them, to be honest, isn't it, right?
That's how you're going to be perceived, no?
Yeah, no, I'm not one of them at all, to be honest.
But listen, you know a lot more than most people.
Yeah, but look.
And that today, where we're living in society where there's such a lack of knowledge around trauma-informed and all these other issues that we're having, somebody that knows more than others is definitely somebody that...
If you do a PhD or an expert.
No, okay. My buddies give me a slagging about that.
You're being humble.
My buddies, no, I'm not. If you knew my group of friends there, no, they actually will bring you down to life fairly quickly.
Don't be calling yourself doctor anytime soon.
I try and do it for the laugh. they literally take the piss completely out of me. But what I was kind of saying is that, I am an expert in a tiny little area. It's one tiny, 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 tiny
area.
But it is important. But kind of what I was kind of saying as well is, I kind of know my limitations too, you know? And that's really important to know my limitations. So what I've done for my own kind of training program, it's called the Well Schools Network. It's a spin out from my PhD. So basically we've turned my PhD project into an actual tangible program that schools can do, right? But what I've done is that I felt a bit disingenuous going in, I haven't done it, but attempting to go in and talk about when we're talking about sensory difficulties, and yes, I do know the different types of sensory breaks and our staff would know, but I don't feel equipped to teach what an occupational therapist can teach the staff. Yeah. So we can all have therapeutic moments in our day, but actually getting training from a trained professional to show you how to do it properly is really, really important. So I brought an occupational therapist, my OT and me, she is Jess Kennedy. She's a phenomenal person. But to teach the staff how to actually give the right type of sensory break, talking about dysregulated adults and children, but sometimes knowledge again is everything, right? And if you have a child who's dysregulated, and you bring them outside and have them running around, it actually makes them become more dysregulated. Mm. So JSROT will teach you how to actually calm down the
hyper child.
Like, not even the hyper child. Like, it's just a child that just needs a calming break.
Yeah.
So, and the language around it, a calming and organizing break or an alerting break.
Just put the Red Bull back in the fridge.
Yeah, or the Prime. My young fella is on about that all the time lately. He sees it on the telly all the time. But, you know, I told him he's not allowed till he's 18.
I seen Dunn's the other day, did a load of them. We're off topic a little bit.
Yeah.
Only 4 per customer. There was nobody buying this stuff, like.
Yeah.
What you said. Do you know that stuff? That started off with a price tag of £15.
I know, initially. Ridiculous.
Oh, Jesus, man. I was over in England last year with Smartha and his friends, and we were at a match. And it was a big deal. Like, the kids were literally, like, crying on the streets for their mums and dads. Because it was on YouTube every day.
That's what my fellow speak. I've never let him have anything like that. Like,
sure, right.
And but it's funny, like, it's like, what's this Prime, Dad? What's this Prime? He's always on about, like, but you know, it's
a load of shit, tell him.
Yeah, just get him an empty bottle and put some diluted into it.
Yeah. But then also, I suppose, one of the things then as well, I suppose, that the student voice part told me, okay, like, and like, we do a lot of outdoor learning, outdoor learning and sustainability and teaching children about, like, sustainable environments. It's actually not teaching them, it's actually just getting them playing outdoors, actually gives them an appreciation of it. But a mad one for you, actually, right? This is a mad one, because one of the things that came up for me was that the kids actually, it wasn't actually doing well in school or achieving. They enjoyed learning, like cognitive well-being and metacognition and learning how we learn. Kids really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I found it mad. Yeah. None of the adults actually picked up on that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because I did a lot of interviews, a lot of focus groups with teachers, principals. But no one actually kind of said, the learning side of things is kind of, is like, except the kids, and they were adamant about it. Boy, I tell you, they were just like, literally, they were kind of saying, yeah, we love learning. And I was like, it has to be your art, or it has to be your, no, we love all the parts of it. We love the actual, they loved it. I think it was just like that learning at their own level.
It was fun for them.
Yeah. I think that's what kind of, that's a thing that I hadn't even thought about.
So if I'm a principal in a school and I'm listening to this or watching this on YouTube, where they should subscribe while they're there. But you know, if I was a principal and I was responsible for a school and I wanted my staff trained in this workshop here or program, how would they go about it?
Just contact. You can contact me, dave@wsn.ie is my email. I will say as well, like, I'm going to say, like, it's not like I think sometimes everyone looks for a quick fix, right?
Yeah.
And a toolbox or a golden pill or something like that.
Yeah.
It kind of doesn't work like that, right? There are some brilliant, brilliant people out there that has training, like training for nurture rooms is fantastic.
Mm.
What I do is really, really good. There's other ones, like there's other programs as well that are trauma informed. Like, I did a program called the Berry Street Model of Education as well. Fantastic as well. They're based in Australia. Like, it's kind of like, what fit is going to fit your school. Like, you know, like if you're with a staff that are open to trauma informed practice and open to this, by all means, give me a call. Like, you know,
talking about staff, say I want to work in your school as a teacher and you're interviewing me. What are you looking for in the teacher? They have their degree and they might have their master's, but what sets them apart? Like, what's the type of personality? What's the type of, for your culture in your school, what are you looking for?
Compassion, I think, is one thing.
How do you find how compassion is something that's probably fake in the arts office?
Yeah, like sometimes you can. Yeah. I have some fabulous people, like just going, I'll give you an example, right? And give an example of what is the wrong answer.
What?
No, it was the wrong answer to the question.
Yeah.
But for me it was the right answer.
Well, I see, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Honesty, I suppose.
Yeah, it was really honest, but like, so basically it was a question about, like, what was the first thing if you do? You're teaching an autism class. And what's the first thing you do? And she kind of said, well, I wouldn't look at their reports for a couple of weeks because I'd like to get to know the individual child first.
No judgment.
And I was kind of like, that's probably the wrong answer. But for me, that was the right thing. Because she wanted to do the right thing by the child. And she didn't want to kind of say, look, she didn't want to look at a form or an assessment.
She'd go in with bias then.
And go in saying, oh, this child does this and does that. But I was kind of like, it was probably the wrong answer. But I really like how...
Yeah.
I really, you know what I mean?
How that could have went wrong for her if it was a different school. If that was a different school, that could have, she would have... lost the interview straight away.
So I kind of, it wasn't actually the right answer, but it was, I liked the way she kind of came about it.
That's the right approach.
I think as well, like having examples, like when people give you examples about
themselves,
yeah, you can kind of see the human touch of some of it.
Because you can see the emotion in her face.
Yeah.
You can't fake emotion.
No, you can't. You can't. You genuinely can't. Like, and like you can't fake. Genuine,
you'll get the energy.
Empathy, either.
And it's just it's there, James. You know, emotion comes through experience, their own experience, particularly if they're talking about it.
And I don't think you can actually. Empathy is another thing that, like, we talk about compassion and empathy. Like, I don't think you can fake empathy. Like, you know, like it's empathy is a thing that's either in you or it's not. Like, you know, and like to be honest with you, I hate interviews anyway because. I think they're the most false things of all time. Do you know what I mean? But at the same time,
evil, isn't it?
Yeah, they are necessary. And
like what you're talking about there is goes back to Carl Rogers' person sent, like what he was talking about. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're working in a capacity where you're helping a vulnerable person, you have to be compassionate. You have to be empathetic, unconditional positive regard.
Yeah.
Like, these are non-negotiables.
That's one of the principles of what I say as well. Unconditional positive regard.
Yeah, well, if you're looking for a wingman on one of them workshops,
yeah, on the ball, I'd love it.
Is there anything you'd like to add before we finish?
No, just thanks a million. You know, it's lovely to have the chat, really, to be honest with you.
Oh, very, very interesting. Yeah. Thank you for coming.
Like, and again, like, you know, like, I kind of, like, teaching is a hard job, like, and I suppose, like, being a principal is a really hard job too, you know, but it kind of, everyone, I suppose, just trying to make sure what I'm trying to do is trying to inform people and give people the bit of knowledge. Because when you know, and you can do something about it, and like,
what you're doing is changing lives. Dude.
Yeah, like, and it's kind of like, do you ever see, I showed this video this morning at a workshop I was doing, you know. Do you ever see the video of Ian Wright there with Mr. Pigeon?
Yeah.
That shows the power of one good adult. Yeah. I think that video, like, it's very an emotive thing.
You see it. Ian Wright is tough. He was a bit of a wild child.
Yeah, he looked at jail, didn't he?
Youth detention. He was on a bad path, but there was this one teacher that looked after him.
Yeah.
And really nurtured him, didn't he? But they reunited for a BBC documentary a couple of years ago. He was wrong crying, wasn't he?
Yeah, but Ian Wright thought he was dead, you know?
Yeah.
And Ian Wright went from, like, being, like, a man in his 50s to being right. Like a 5-year-old.
They brought about as a surprise, you know?
And I swear to God, it just shows you the importance of what one good adult can do. Like, and that's kind of like...
We all have one, someone like that. That's why you get emotional, you think, because we all have that one adult in our lives, or two, maybe.
You'd be bawling if you saw this video. Yeah. Like, genuinely. But what I always say to the staff, like, is imagine, right, every adult in the whole building was your one good adult, right? And imagine the transformational power that can have, right? And like one of my teachers summed it up brilliantly one day, and probably in better way that I could, is like we were kind of thinking of ways to kind of sum things up about what we want to do and what we want to be. And she summed it up brilliantly. She said she loved the saying of, be the teacher that you needed when you were a child.
That's it, boy.
And I think that kind of
that is it.
Kind of leave it like that. Like, so if every teacher kind of had that
and
kind of trauma informed knowledge, and then applying
it on the child and finding out what they need to, isn't it? That could be take time.
But even like having that one good adult, or a school full of good adults, can be a brilliant counterweight to the difficulties they experience at home.
Well, relationship is the buffer. Like, relationship is the big regulator. Like, I know Bruce Perry there, we were talking about him.
We should get him on, actually. There's a lot of talk about Bruce.
Yeah, you should get him.
Yeah, we should actually. Leave it with me. That was a joke. Yeah, say no more.
But basically, he often says it.
Yeah.
Relationship is the buffer.
And
relational regulation is the best form of regulation. Yeah. You know, so it's kind of about the people and about the
good way to finish, Dave.
Thanks, Will.
Thanks for your time.
Cheers. Thanks, Will.
Pleasure talking. Thanks. See everybody next week. God bless, lads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.